There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing.
On.
There is this thing going on.
What?
Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Hello. It is Tuesday, April 16th, just around 5 o'clock, and you are listening to the Local Journalism Initiative Roundup here on CKUT. I'm your host, Jules Bugel, and today on the show, we have coverage of basically, I would say, some of the main labor issues happening in the city. It's a labor-heavy episode, and the big news on that front is that McGill's TA union has finally come to a tentative agreement with the university after being on strike since March 25th. Now, the TA strike has thrown a wrinkle into final season this year, but so far it's yielded results. Before the strike vote, McGill was offering a 6% raise over 4 years. That figure went up to 14.5% over the same time frame and could very well be higher in the new tentative agreement, but we don't know yet as the details haven't been released to the public and won't be. The union says they're withholding comment until presenting it to members at a general assembly this Thursday starting at 5 p.m. But we've got lots of other labor news on the show today. Last week, another union voted no on their tentative agreement, and that's who we're starting off today's show with. That no vote sent leadership back to the bargaining table with the province of Quebec. I'm talking about the FIQ, Quebec's nursing union, whose 80,000 members were asked to vote on their agreement in principle from last Wednesday through Friday. 77% of members showed up to vote, with 61% voting to reject the deal. The agreement offered salary gains of 17.4% over 5 years and introduced new premiums for work on evenings, weekends, and nights, as well as an acknowledgement that the government would shift away from the use of mandatory overtime, except for in emergency situations. Now, at the McGill University Health Center, the agreement was met with some pretty fierce opposition by union members who say it introduces a dangerous new precedent around mobility. With just 30 days' notice, a nurse could be reassigned to a healthcare center up to 25 kilometers away, and that's 35 kilometers off island. The government still argues, even after the no vote, that this flexibility is necessary to fill in staffing gaps. But my guest, who heads the MUHC's local, argues that the government's insistence on this flexibility from nurses will push people to leave the province or the profession. Here's our conversation recorded during the vote last week. Take a listen.
So my name is Jenny Ree, and I am the current president of the SPSICR, which is the Union for Nursing and Cardiorespiratory of the McGill University Health Center.
You guys are voting on an agreement in principle that the FIQ union reached with the Quebec government, but obviously there was a lot that led up to this point. Can you just give me an overview of, you know, what were some of the issues in the nursing sector that led to the FIQ really pushing for a much stronger agreement than even the province had initially put on the table?
Right. So I can tell you that our collective agreement usually runs for a term of 3 years. And our last one expired in March of last year, so 2023. We're now a year later, and we start, of course, our negotiations always go a little bit before the end of the next one. So it feels like sometimes we're running one negotiation into another. The Quebec government would very much like to ratify us for 5 years. So we started this negotiation process roughly 16 months ago. And we were very clear. It was a process that we wanted this round to make about 100% about our membership, what their priorities were. So we did a huge consultation, not last September, but the September before. And we asked people in a form of a sondage, like a questionnaire, what were their priorities? What was it that they were looking for in the next collective agreement? What was important to them? And we came out with three priorities. It was remuneration, let's face it, it's number one. Then it was like work-life balance. People wanted very much more control over their schedules, more control over their lives, basically. And three, it was workload. So we understand that since the pandemic and with the exodus of a lot of healthcare professionals, our workloads are, quite honestly, off the charts right now. You can go to work on a regular 8 hours, but most of us do 12 at the MUHC, and you come back so exhausted to the point where you cannot even enjoy your day off. So that being said, we focused on those priorities, and we really went into this negotiation. We consulted every step of the way. And the first collective agreement that came, and they were offering us, I think, a remuneration of 9%, and that was rejected pretty much at 99.99% at the delegation level. It didn't even come to the membership. This round, they presented us this tentative agreement. We listened to it. We debated it for two solid days. We couldn't agree, but it passed. It passed by a slim margin of 53%. What that meant was that 53% of the delegates across Quebec felt it was worthy to bring back to their members. We at the MUHC, we were actually the first ones to get up and present our dissidence. A dissidence is something that does not happen very often. It's a very serious matter, and it's when we cannot agree with our own federation, and we say, look, we're not going to ratify, we're not going to rally, and we're not going to recommend to our memberships to accept this tentative agreement, and this is where we are right now.
Yeah, and I'd like, if you could, tell me a little bit more about what your main issues are in the collective agreement, because when you look at remuneration, I mean, obviously nursing is very different than a lot of the other public sector professions, which saw strikes last fall, but you know, the 17.4% increase over 5 years is pretty much on par with what the rest of the public sector was offered by the provincial government. And, you know, obviously not everybody was happy about that either, but those agreements were accepted. And, you know, the FIQ negotiation, it concluded after, and nursing has all these different provisions in terms of geography and overtime and all of these different things that from the outside are maybe not totally clear just why these would be such sticking points for you and your membership.
Okay, so if we talk about strictly remuneration, the 17.4, yes, was on par with the rest of the Common Front. However, the Common Front, there is one crucial difference. They did not lose 3.5% from their last collective agreement. So for them, the 17.4, albeit there were people who liked it, people who were less than pleased, it was ratified. They accepted it, okay, and through their democratic process. But with us, when you look at a 17.4 increase and you subtract the 3.5% that we were paid since the pandemic, and then also it was in our last collective agreement, the government has since removed it. So it was during the pandemic, the government offered us, the Guardian Angels, a 3.5 premium to, you know, it was a pandemic premium. And for those working, we all got it. Then they put it in our collective agreement that it was called the FIC premium. It was a reconnaissance, okay, to recognize the work that we do. They gave us a 3.5% premium. It was removed because our collective agreement is no longer valid. It expired last the March before. So they said, we're removing it. They did it arbitrarily, single-handedly. So right now, the 17.4, let's be clear, is actually a 13.9. Divide that by 5 years, which is the term of the contract, and you're getting less than 3% per year, which isn't even keeping with the cost of living. So that's why we're not happy about the 17.4.
You hear about always these stories of, well, if I, you know, went to the U.S., if I worked as a travel nurse, like there's even if I moved across Canada, right, as a nurse, there are better options to be paid. But obviously, payment is not the only thing on the table. There's all these non-monetary conditions as well in the collective agreement. And I'm wondering if you could talk about some of those in terms of mandatory overtime, in terms of, you know, moving nurses around, because, you know, part of what we heard from the health minister was basically wanting more control over moving healthcare staff to healthcare facilities that had a shortage. And I think across not just nurses, but healthcare unions in the Common Front as well, this has been a point of contention over, you know, how much control government is going to have to reassign people in this manner.
Absolutely. So, you know, even more than remuneration, I think for us, the biggest reason why we had to put in our dissidence, and we cannot recommend it, and I've been a nurse in this réseau, in the public system. I've always worked for McGill. I would like to just say in my 36 years, I've never seen anything like this. Santé Québec, Bill 15, what they are, you know, what they pushed through with a gag order just before the holidays, it's going to change the public system as we know it. And while the MUHC has not had anything as serious as like forced overtime, we do have what's called non-replacement. So double your workload if somebody calls in sick and things like that. But the major reason why we object to this tentative agreement is the fact on mobility. It is non-negotiable and it is horrendous what they are proposing. And if I could just explain, what is on the collective agreement, tentative agreement right now, is that the government wants to have mobility. And by this, it means that with 30 days notice, should this be accepted, of course, with 30 days notice, it gives them the right to move a healthcare employee from either their location, so their home base, they will define it two ways, either your home, like your residential address, or your home base where you are currently working. So on the island of Montreal, they are proposing that they can move a healthcare employee within 30 days to another location, another employer. Well, it's going to be one employer. This is what they're heading towards, but another establishment, and you don't have a say. So our concern with that is that, let's say myself, I'm living in the North Shore. I choose to come in to the MUHC. They move me to Lakeshore, okay, like West Island. And then from there, the 30 days, okay, they can move you again another 25 kilometers. And off island, they're proposing 35 kilometers. Now, where we see a problem with that is we are 92% women. We are mothers, young mothers. We are, you know, we chose daycares. We have elderly parents. We chose, you know, to live by a metro so that we could commute or walk to work even. This is going to be a nightmare. And people have already started calling us saying they're preparing for their NCLEX. NCLEX is a licensing exam in the U.S. People are writing their CVs and applying out of province because they have families in Ontario or New Brunswick or wherever. Okay, people are looking really at their career choices right now. And I look at these beautiful nursing students, even coming from the Ingram School of Nursing at McGill. They're young, they're bright. You know, statistically, many of them will not stay in this profession. And that's what I find sad, to invest, you know, 3 years, 4 years of your life, even more, to get your bachelor's degree in nursing and not even stay because the working conditions and the control that the government wishes to exercise over you is beyond what is acceptable.
You know, the big rationale behind the bill is just, well, this modernization will help patients. It will help them see healthcare providers more. It will help, you know, decrease wait times. I guess, you know, what is your response to that? As somebody working in the sector, how do we actually solve these big issues that Bill 15 is trying to solve and halt this exodus of healthcare workers that we're seeing in the province as well?
Bill 15, I know that they really want and they think it will help the system. We look at it a little bit differently. I think the notion, and people say, well, what's your solution? What do you think will work? There are areas that are really needing healthcare professionals. I think the government needs to put something in place that on a voluntary basis, and we did it during the pandemic. We left by truckloads, even though we were short ourselves. We were encouraged to go and help other people, let's say in Chicoutimi or somewhere. We went as teams, and we did that to help our colleagues and also to help the citizens of Quebec. On a voluntary basis, if the government was to provide an initiative or some kind of incentive to go and, let's say, you know, work in a place that is just dire straits, they need help, and offer a financial incentive to go, let's say, you know, and they're trying. They have a little clause that's saying, you know, if you're within 50 kilometers and you volunteer to go, we'll give you $50, $100 outside of those kilometers, et cetera. That being said, if they had something in place where people could make a choice on where they go and they're properly remunerated for these choices to go voluntarily help out, I think that would be a good solution. I think we should start there. I'm telling you right now, there are many, many people, if told that they are going to be moving within 30 days, their resignation letters are ready. And my fear for that is that we cannot afford to lose more. And the government they don't see it. They never consult the people on the ground. And as far as decentralizing and centralizing, there are models in BC, I think in New Zealand, and in Australia. They've tried to centralize, and they wound up undoing everything because it was so big, they just couldn't do it. Even at the MUHC, okay, they had communications and legal affairs now taken away from our local establishment, which we all controlled our own across the province. They took it away. They're managing it in Quebec City. Okay, more and more we're becoming, how can I say, we have less say. There's directives coming down from the ministry. MUHC has to abide by ministerial orders. And it's really changing what I would say is the flavor of MUHC, unfortunately. A lot of us chose to work at MUHC because we had wonderful relationships with our employer. We had wonderful relationships with our managers. But they, too, are now having to fit a cookie-cutter mold that everybody's doing the same thing, and the response is the same for every situation. And you can't do that with human beings. You just can't.
Yeah. And you know, using the carrot, not the stick, seems to be something that they at least tried to do with this 3.5% bonus during the pandemic. And so, yeah, it is a question why that kind of approach couldn't continue. But going back to the collective agreement, you know, your members are voting on it currently. You know, what do you think is going to happen? What are you hearing from both the folks that you're working with and other units of the FIQ outside of your hospital? Do you have any kind of sense of how the folks on the ground are responding to this proposal?
So the reason it passed at 52-53% at the delegation was there are establishments, let's say, in what we call les régions, okay? So like, let's say Saguenay-Lac-Saint-Jean, you know, their establishments are more than 35 kilometers apart. And you would, in this new proposal, have the right to refuse if it's more than 35 kilometers. So for them, the mobility issue doesn't touch them as much. I did hear talk that people are saying, well, we don't want to strike anymore. And, you know, it's not something that we want to tell the government. But our people at MUHC, and I'm only speaking for our people who I represent, they're ready to strike again. They're saying this is inadequate. We're not happy. We didn't strike for 8 days to get this, and we're ready to go again. Give us the respect that we deserve. We earned it. And I hold true to that, and I will till the day I go. I'm eligible to retire, but I really, really think it's important to see this contract through for our members and for the new generation of people coming. But I am concerned. I am very concerned that, you know, it's always been, for some reason, our sector, that a small minority vote for the majority. So this round, what we're doing very differently is we're calling everyone one person at a time. And regardless of what your belief is, you know, I say this honestly, even if you vote for it, I don't care. I want you to vote. I want all 80,000 of our members to vote and have a collective say in the future of our profession and in the future of our contract moving forward. So yes, at the MUHC, we're telling people what it means, but we're honest and we're saying there are some gains. I can't say that there's not gains. They're offering, you know, certain premiums have gone up and certain things have, but it's not equitable. And that's another reason why we couldn't recommend it. It is very set up for people to be full-time. Why does this government want everybody to be full-time? Nursing is very attractive to, let's say, women because they can work part-time. And when you're having young children or you have situations in your families that you can't work full-time, then it's unfair to be punished and not treated, you know, as equally as a full-time person. And that's another reason why we cannot recommend.
If I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying the government is asking nurses to be flexible, but it's not giving them that same flexibility in other areas.
It's really not. And I know for a fact, at least at the MUHC, and I speak honestly for our members, they're like, I can't do this. I can't do this anymore. So if I'm told to move and I purchase my house right beside the Glen, let's say, and I can walk and all of a sudden I'm moving, I don't have a car, I don't drive, it's going to add another hour to my commute. I'm not doing that. And they're saying, well, we're ready. We're just going to quit. That's okay. And there are people who are right, like me, who are riding this wave to see, okay, let's see when it's stable and then we can get off this train. But, you know, that might just force us to leave earlier. So there's a lot of people, I mean, more than 20% who are eligible to retire. And if we left in one fell swoop, it would be disastrous for this réseau.
I mean, let's all hope that we don't end up seeing that, you know, for all Quebecers. But, you know, as you said, yeah, this is on the table. So
it's scary. And I just, if I could add one last thing, I know it sounds that we are really, you know, only out for ourselves. That's not true. We've always been advocates, okay, and advocates for the public. That is the definition of our profession, is that we advocate for our sick patients. And this tentative agreement, should it pass, the repercussions from that will be very, very damaging to the general public. And that's ultimately what I want to say, is that I'm very, very concerned of where healthcare is going. We've already heard about the shortages of doctors. And, you know, for the first time in history, McGill Med has vacancies in their family med program. That's unusual. People are not wanting to stay in Quebec. Well, why is that? This CAQ government were beside us, side by side, during the Barrette reform. And they said, oh my gosh, if you elect us, we're going to do so much. You know, we're going to do you right. We're going to treat you well. We, you know, healthcare professionals deserve so much more. They even put on our lab coats, you know, our coats and our scrubs, and were sitting beside us arguing with the Liberal government. Where are they today? They're in power, and they're treating us worse than the Liberal government ever did.
That was Jenny Ree, president of the Union of Nursing and Cardiorespiratory Professionals of the MUHC, McGill University Health Center, speaking with CQUT on April 11th. I'm Jules Pujol. Thanks so much for listening. Media workers staged a protest outside the National Film Board's headquarters in Montreal's Quartier des Spectacles on Thursday, just a week after the NFB laid off around 55 workers across the country. Two-thirds of those layoffs were in Montreal. Here's Olivier Lamotte from the Syndicat Général du Cinéma et de la Télévision, Local 4835, under the Canadian Union of Public Employees.
Well, it's always a shock when people are let go, and it's always a shock when you find out that everything that you do wholeheartedly seems like it's vanishing away. It's put to trash. So that's pretty much the echoes that I get from our members. So a huge sense of distress, lack of understanding what's going on, and what's the plan de match. Those things, we don't know what's the plan for their internal reorganization. So people are left in the dark.
NFB spokesperson Lily Robert says the layoffs are necessary to help the NFB endure and keep up with the changing world of production. They also come with 23 new jobs across the film board, an extra 6 in the innovation lab, and $5 million in savings that'll be reinvested into the creation of films.
We call that modernization, but we could have called it a new chapter. Because at the end of the day, we reinvest the money. We reinvest $5 million directly in production for creators to create, to tell the stories of Canadian and to create documentaries and animation. And you know, those two genres are very, very popular, but they are also very fragile.
But this latest round of layoffs is just one part of the larger restructuring at the film board. The NFB ended two executive producer roles in December and closed its Montreal and Vancouver-based interactive studios in January. It's also chosen not to fill a number of vacant positions. Combined with the most recent round of layoffs, that's 83 jobs lost out of a roughly 400-person staff, counting for more than 20% of the NFB's workforce, though some will likely be rehired in new positions. In the past, the NFB has seen criticism for administrative bloat, but Lamotte says the problem is the organization's budget, which is right about where it was 20 years ago, though its real value has decreased substantially. By the union's estimates, that's created a roughly $20 million shortfall.
Well, it's no secret that the NFB has been quietly defunded in the last 20 years. That $20 million, that is a manque à gagner, that's where you need to get the money to reinvest in production. Not by cutting jobs and restructuring. It's like cutting your finger to eat at dinner time just for survival. It seems like there's no logic in that.
One of those affected by the layoffs is Anne Koizumi, an advisor for educational programming at the NFB. She says she doesn't know how her work on the education file will continue with almost the whole team out of jobs.
Well, it's really shocking. I mean, I've been working in education for 12 years at the National Film Board, and I was totally blindsided. My entire team was blindsided. Again, like 90% of us were cut. We were doing incredible work. We were getting these films and our educational resources into the classroom, and that's not happening anymore. I mean, I don't know how that's going to happen without our team.
Robert says the layoffs in education are part of a larger effort to make their films more accessible.
Education remains an important part of our mission. We just want to rethink the sector. And the main difference is that before, education was more aligned on the traditional way of doing things. So there was a paywall, for example. A teacher had to pay, or the scholar, the school had to pay to have access to the content, okay? Now we want to do a more accessible, available, free online education offer.
But Koizumi says that staff just aren't seeing the vision.
It's extremely heartbreaking, not just for the employees who lost their jobs, but for the institution as a whole. Like, we want the NFB to stick around. We wanted it to grow. And, you know, the way that it grows is a huge part of that is through our distribution channels and through reaching out to young Canadians. And that's what we felt that we were doing. And we don't see that right now. We don't see that in the vision. I mean, what do I want for the NFB? I want it to stick around. I want it to be here for the next, you know, 100, 200 years. And I want the legacy to continue. But right now, I don't know what the vision is if we just keep cutting jobs and we keep... Yeah, we just keep cutting. I just don't know.
I'm Jules Bijal. Thanks for listening.
No matter your disability, you likely face barriers in your everyday life. At Neil Squire, we help break those barriers down by helping you access employment, technology, and the tools you need to live your life to the fullest. As a nonprofit organization, we empower people with disabilities all across Canada, and we are here for you too. Visit neilsquire.ca to learn more.
Production Nuit d'Afrique presents Malian superstar Oumu Sangaré, who has influenced the likes of Beyoncé and Alicia Keys. Oumu Sangaré will perform an exclusive concert at M. Tillus on April 21st, 2024. Tickets and info at festivalnuitdafrique.com.
This is Kristen Carter. My debut contemporary pop album, Full Bloom, is now yours to discover. Full Bloom is a living garden of 12 songs that celebrates the beauty and the seasonal nature of life. You can find Full Bloom wherever you listen to music. Visit thekristencarter.com or follow at Kristen Carter Music for more. Funded by Factor and Canada's private radio broadcasters.
It's just past 5:30 on April 16th. You're listening to the local Journalism Initiative Roundup here on CKUT, broadcast on 90.3 FM in Montreal and online worldwide at ckut.ca. I'm your host, Jules Bujel. Last Thursday, McGill Law hosted their annual Prue Lecture on the theme of prison abolition. Panelists Elle Jones, Deborah Parks, and Justin Pichet spoke about the harms that come from incarceration. Here's Pichet, a U Ottawa criminology professor and director of the Carceral Studies Research Collective.
We know through the literature and through experience that imprisonment further entrenches oppressive structures of power. Name the oppressive ism. I'm not trying to be glib here, but human caging perpetrates and perpetuates them all.
The panelists spoke about the overlap between prison abolition and disability justice, the pro-Palestine movement, environmentalism, as well as highlighting some of the barriers to fighting against prisons within a legal framework. Here's Deborah Parks, chair in feminist legal studies at the Peter A. Allard School of Law at UBC, on what happens even when the movement sees legal victories.
The whole regime of administrative segregation was found to violate the Charter, both in substance and in procedure. I won't go into the details, but this is a significant win, both at trial and then upheld by two different courts of appeal, and the federal government did not appeal it to the Supreme Court of Canada. I don't think they wanted that precedent. Do you all know what happened next? New legislation was enacted to create something called structured intervention units, SIUs. They look a lot like segregation units. In most cases, they are the exact same cells. They have new rules and layers of mostly internal review processes. On paper, they are held out as meeting the constitutional standards to prevent unconstitutional solitary confinement, but the government's own data show that the standards are not, even those standards are not being met. What's more, there are other forms of solitary confinement called by many other names: medical observation, voluntary limited association ranges, and more, that involve no oversight whatsoever. There is now a new round of litigation that will challenge the SIU regime as unconstitutional. So writing in 2016, when the Charter litigation was still ongoing, before even the trial decision had been rendered, I wrote, and I just looked back on this in preparation for today, "Herein lies the problem of prisoner rights litigation that is not accompanied by a critique of carceral logics. If, for example, we seek only to abolish those smaller cages, solitary confinement, but leave intact the logic of caging people in the first place, then some other correctional tool or practice will take the place of solitary and we will soon be fighting that," end quote. I don't say that in any way to be self-congratulatory. There are no winners here. Incarcerated people lose in every scenario. But I was worried at the time, and I still am, about how lawyering and litigation in particular can be part of an abolitionist vision or not. And in the wake of the 2020 uprisings, Black Lives Matter, defund the police movements, there's more attention to these ideas of abolition, and I now encounter quite a few students that come to law school saying they are abolitionist. This was extremely rare before the last few years, I can say, for law school, and it's exciting. But I think there's a danger that we might see, and I'm speaking to myself, not speaking like at anyone else, I'm just speaking about our moment, that we might see abolitionist as an identity, as a badge of honor in some ways. I'm opposed to regressive institutions and systems, when in fact abolition, it's about doing. And frankly, there's a lot to do.
Joy James has talked to us about abolition becoming an extremely classed practice, where those who are the victims of police violence, those who are inside prisons, are actually the last that we consult on abolition. While we ourselves, and I'm indicting myself here, I am an academic, we as academics, we as people of class advantage, make abolition a kind of like totem for ourselves.
Speaking now is Elle Jones, a poet, journalist, professor, and activist who served as Halifax's Poet Laureate and the Nancy's Chair in Women's Studies at Mount St. Vincent University. She published the poetry and prose book Abolitionist Intimacies in 2022.
I talk in my book about a man named Jerry Cruz. I can say his name, he said so. Serving life, more than life, he's actually at 36 years right now. And I talk in my book about during 2020, when there was a lot of discussion on defunding and abolition, Jerry started asking people in the prison, like, what would abolition look like, effectively, was the question. And they were all like, you can't abolish prison. I'm like, there's fucked up people in here. You know, so like they would just be like, oh, well, maybe more halfway houses. And he's like, okay, but if we were moving away from the system. So even those who could see for themselves what was so destructive, who could admit that they kept coming back to prison, and in fact, because they were living under the system, would say things like, but people are bad people, they just keep coming back, as though that were not an indictment of the system. And my point here is not to mock those people, suggest that they are somehow, if only they read 10 books on abolition. My point is that those who live under this oppression have themselves don't even have the mental space to be able to actually contemplate the system that oppresses them. So when I say that when Jerry had these conversations, again, I'm not saying that to diminish the people in prison. I'm saying that to talk about the gap between those who live under the boot of the state and those of us outside it who have the luxury to walk away at any time. So what does that call upon us when we say we're abolitionists?
The panelists made the point that if people on the inside experience such high barriers to abolition, people on the outside have a duty to engage in the tough conversations that come with it, including about people like Paul Bernardo, who caused a public uproar when he was moved from a maximum to medium security prison.
Those cases then allow a cascade where if we allow these violations to happen to Paul Bernardo, who is, I think, for everybody, one of the most, like, the people that we would most condemn, of course, it then feeds down to everybody else, and that will eventually, of course, be also the indigenous woman who, like,
it's already,
killed her abuser. And
it's
it is,
already,
right?
not even eventually.
You know, I think, first of all, there was a ton of misinformation, and also around the hockey rink, like, you know, so recreation is part of, like, it's part of health. You actually have a right to be outside. And in fact, obviously, the guards will tell you, like, they'd rather people be in the gym, like, tiring themselves out, getting some exercise, getting their stress out, than being on the range locked up, where then, of course, it's actually going to result in more stress, more mental health issues, more violence, more containment. So just on a practical level, before we even take, like, put in the politics, there was so much that was being lied about in terms of what a medium security meant, what cascading down meant, what a prison actually looks like, what actually takes place in terms of programming and the day, that was just about this fear-mongering and moral panic. And every time we've had this in Canada, which you talk about, Deb, it leads to this ill-thought-out reactionary legislation. So they're like, nobody can cascade out of a max.
Yeah. It happened with healing lodges and Indigenous healing lodges, where there was, a story about someone being transferred to a healing lodge. And that's the correctional name for this place, is a healing lodge. And that one is a correctional run one. There are other facilities and programs and supports and community that are run by Indigenous nations themselves that are vastly underfunded, in fact, mostly not funded by CSE, even though they have legislation to do so. So all that to say, there's things we should be advocating for rather than CSE-run healing lodges. But even in that, once you had a high-profile person who was going to a healing lodge, all of a sudden you had a whole new policy making it harder for Indigenous women to go to healing lodges, and men for that matter. And so this is what we have to constantly be resisting. It's just a constant battle, I think.
Despite the setbacks, Pichet says he's spoken with prisoners who are doing the work of making prison abolition practical, but that there's also a lot of groundwork that needs to be laid for real abolition across Canada, and that for anyone who's interested in the movement, supporting these efforts is where the most important work lies.
Prison abolition is about eradicating cages, and so when we're thinking about how do we get there? Let's dream for a second and imagine what kinds of things we would need in our society to do to prevent violence to the extent that is possible, and then when violence occurs, to then respond to it and still produce tangible safety for others. I'm not saying I have answers for a particular person that's been like a lightning rod around conditions of confinement in medium. But like, I think we have to like not allow ourselves to get sucked into the dangerous few trap and try and say, well, wait a second, it's taken several generations to get to where we are now. It might take several generations to get out of it. Hopefully not. We need abolition now. I believe that. But, let's dream a bit here. And if we get accused to be dreamers, well, okay, that's fine, but, like, I'm here for change.
To learn more about Pichet's work, you can visit the Montreal launch of How to Abolish Prisons, Lessons from the Movement Against Imprisonment, which he co-wrote with Rachel Herzang. That launch takes place on May 4th at Articule, following a drop-in workshop and exposition on prisoner solidarity. I'm Jules Bigel. Thanks for listening. All right, and we are back live on air on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, and I have
Evan Fox Decent on the line. So as you heard earlier on the program, the TAs may have ended picketing, but McGill Law Profs could be next on April 11th. The Association of McGill Professors of Law, also known as AMPL, announced that they're ready to go on indefinite strike if McGill doesn't put forth an agreement in principle by April 23rd. This follows a one-day strike in February in response to what they argued was bad faith negotiations by the university. On the line, we have the president of the association, law professor Evan Fox Decent. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Carly. It's wonderful to be here.
So the AMPL is the first professor union at McGill. Can you just walk us through in broad strokes how it came into being? You know, why did law profs need a union at McGill?
Yeah, well, certainly. Thank you, Carly. So we filed for certification some time ago now. It was in November of 2021, so a little more than 2.5 years ago. And the growing feeling in our faculty was, I believe, that we just did not have an effective voice in controlling the governance of our own faculty, which, like most of the faculties, and as far as I know, all the faculties in McGill operate somewhat separately from one another. They all have deans. They all tend to have their own reality, their own way of doing teaching and research. And so there are a number of issues about the way that we were delivering our academic mission that we thought could be addressed better if faculty had more direct input into them, such as more faculty input into our appointments process, more faculty input into how we select our deans. We, to date, it's a very, very cloistered, very closed process. We don't know even who the candidates are who are being considered for dean, and deans now at McGill tend to have two consecutive five-year terms, so that's effectively a 10-year term in most cases, and we think we should have at least the opportunity to let our voices be known about the candidates who would make a short list. So that's an example of, you know, some of the issues that were percolating at the time. Of course, part of what happened at the time, too, was in the time of COVID, and our faculty, together with others, had sent a letter to the administration asking for a requirement that if people wanted to come back onto campus for learning at that point, they had to show a proof of vaccination. And if they were not willing to get vaccinated or had not got vaccinated for any reason, we would nevertheless teach them, but we would do it by hybrid through Zoom until such time as, you know, we got past the worst of the health crisis with COVID. The university refused to even discuss this matter. The General University Teachers Association, MAUT, had made the same kind of plead, and their request went unanswered or unheeded as well. And then we discovered that the provost had, in fact, sent around a memo asking chairs and deans to provide to him the names of colleagues who had asked or who had taught remotely, specifying that an adequate ground for teaching remotely was not the possibility of endangering somebody living under your own roof because they were immunocompromised or had a specific health condition. So we thought at that point that crystallized for a number of us the sense in which we were not, you know, really being treated as colleagues as we thought we ought to be treated, and we just thought that we needed better control over what was happening in our own faculty, a greater voice in helping to, frankly, run and manage the university and its affairs. And so we aren't asking to, of course, you know, take over from the top down in any way, shape, or form. But I think what did happen in our faculty was that there was a growing sense that we were being treated as subordinates, and what we wanted to be treated as were partners. And that's really what we're looking for now, is co-management and co-partnership with the university's administration in running McGill.
Yeah,
or at least our faculty.
Sure. And fast forwarding to today, you know, if I understand correctly, the reason why this indefinite strike is on the table is because the union said that the university just has not been engaging in good faith when it comes to establishing a collective agreement. And I'm, you know, you spoke about wanting, you know, the profs wanting to have a more active role and feeling like things were top down. You know, my question is just, how have the negotiations process, I guess, has that changed anything? Like, what does it mean for McGill to actually be engaging in bad faith in this process?
Well, so I will say we have met a number of times with McGill's negotiating team. And so sitting across from us has been Fabrice Lebeau, the deputy provost, our dean, Robert Leckie, Francis Desjardins, the head of McGill's HR and labor relations, as well as Corrado DiStefano, who is McGill's external counsel from BLG. So we have met a number of times with them, and we have come to resolution on a number of articles that will go into our collective agreement. But it's now a year and a half since we started negotiation. We still haven't got from McGill even a number, to give you a sense, even a number as to what they're prepared to offer us with respect to salary. So we made a concrete proposal to them. They came back to us, and their proposal was, well, we will give you over the course of the collective agreement just whatever we wish to give you on a discretionary basis. And of course, we would not even have representation on the committee that under MAUT is able to at least consult with McGill's administration with respect to salary policy. So we can't even tell you sort of what their, you know, response to us is yet on that. We're still waiting for that and hoping that it will be coming to us shortly. But matters such as that are just emblematic of what we've faced over the last year and a half. So the norm in collective bargaining, if one's engaging it in good faith, is that you'll meet once a week. Two parties will meet once a week, work through articles sort of piece by piece as they go, typically build a little momentum and a bit of rapport and be able to make progress. But it's been extremely difficult to get meetings with McGill. So, for example, our next scheduled meeting with McGill is April 23rd. It's only a half day. And the next day they said they were prepared to meet with us was on June 7th, which is just, to us, that's not negotiating in good faith or bad faith at all. It's just refusing to negotiate. And this winter, we've only had the opportunity to meet with them on two or three occasions. And on one of those occasions, on the last day that we met with them, which was April 9th, they canceled half the day. They only showed up for half the day. So our sense is that they just are not giving this process the seriousness that we think it deserves. And we're just at the point where we believe we need to exercise the right to strike that we have under the Quebec Labor Code, or at least the threat of it, hopefully to get them to the table this week or very early next week with a view to resolving it. We believe with two, at most 3 days of honest, good faith negotiation, this could all be over. We could resolve these issues. We've gone through most of the more difficult issues that have to, you know, from a substantive point of view, that have to be worked out, things like leaves and tenure and appointments and so forth. Now we're really down to questions of salary, questions of defining in certain respects the duties of our faculty members, but these are not huge, difficult issues to resolve if we just simply have the time to work with them to work these out. We think we can do it, and we're hopeful that, you know, they will come to this conclusion as well and sit down and negotiate with us in good faith.
Yeah, so what you're saying then is, obviously you put the announcement out on April 11th, you know, it sounds like you haven't nailed down negotiation days to come to the table in the days since then?
No, it's been frustrating. We have heard nothing back from McGill yet. We communicated to McGill yesterday that we are prepared to meet with them as of today and sit at the table until such time as we have an agreement. And as I said, I don't think this is going to be more than 2 or 3 intensive days of negotiation. McGill did conclude an agreement with McClue, the course lecturers union, with two extensive days, back-to-back days of negotiation. And they've just concluded the same thing with AGSEM, with the TAs, with essentially the same process. So we know how it can get done. We know that McGill has done it recently. Possibly now with the TA strike settled, they'll be able to turn some attention toward us. But we've yet to hear from them, and hope to hear from them soon.
Yeah, I was meaning to ask about the TAs actually, because just earlier today they announced that they've reached a tentative agreement. Details of that are not yet public, but there's going to be a general assembly on Thursday. So that's after strike started, I believe, on March 25th, and over the course of that strike, their salary offer from McGill has increased, even though we don't know what it is right now. Like we saw before they voted to strike, it was something like 6%. The latest was maybe 14.5. So, in that sense, a strike vote and then a strike did move things on the McGill side. Are there any sort of takeaways from the past few weeks of the TA strikes that the AMPL has taken a note of, as you are progressing your negotiations?
Well, absolutely. So as you mentioned earlier, we did a one-day strike earlier in the year. And, to us, we thought it was actually very, very impactful and got a lot of media attention and really helped to, bring our members, I think, closer into solidarity with one another in a manner that they had not been before. But of course, as university professors, we do provide a public good, and that public good is education. And if we go on strike during the usual academic school year, we are withdrawing our labor and depriving our students. No, it was just a day of teaching, but depriving them of a day of teaching. And of course, some colleagues had students prepared who were lined up to do presentations or other special events. And so there's a significant cost to that. So part of the reason that we've held off now until after the regular winter term of classes are over is to avoid depriving students of that. But one of the things that became very clear to us during the TA strike is the extent to which grading matters to McGill. It matters so much to McGill that McGill went out of its way to instruct its professors who work with teaching assistants to grade the work that TAs would ordinarily be grading while TAs were on strike, which in colloquial terms is just scabbing, right? It's doing replacement work of striking workers. And there were conflicting legal opinions about whether this was legal or not. It was clearly putting university professors in a legally precarious position, and many of them ask questions about it. In law, we don't have TAs, but colleagues in arts and other faculties ask questions about this. And McGill's ultimate response was, we don't care. Mark, just grade the exams, do the work that the TAs are usually supposed to do, and we'll indemnify you. If you are fined because what you're doing is unlawful, we'll pay the fine that you would otherwise pay for engaging in this illegality. So we think it's frankly shocking that McGill would instruct its professors to engage in behavior of this legally precarious, of such a legally precarious nature. But it was revealing to us the extent to which grading is particularly important to them. And it is, of course, important to them because so much depends on grading for students to go on to the next level, to show that they've done something, to make applications, all the rest of it. So what we are essentially going into now is a grading strike. We've given our exams have been turned in. Students will be able to write their exams, but if we do not reach an agreement by April 24th, we will not be grading our exams, and there's no one out there who can grade them. Because law is, in every jurisdiction, it's kind of like a barnacle on a ship. It's its own little creature, and the subfields are highly specialized. And every course that every law instructor teaches is very idiosyncratic, more or less, to that what that instructor has decided to teach. That there really is no way for there's no practical way for or fair way for the university to use substitute graders for us. So we think that that provides a certain amount of leverage right now, which we wish we didn't have to use or exercise, and certainly we don't want to exercise it. We just want the university to come back to the table and negotiate with us, so that the issue of holding back grading doesn't arise. But frankly, it seems to be the only thing that the university, from what we have seen through the TA strike, really cares about. Now, we know there are other things the university cares about. There are significant conferences coming to the university in June, and we do intend to be in touch with the organizers of those conferences to let them know that McGill may be an institution where professors at that institution are striking, and ask them to consider moving to an alternative venue if McGill does not reach a settlement with us by a certain time.
Yeah, and as anybody who's in the sort of McGill grad school world at all knows, I think this past year McGill had a lot of conferences, so we might see some big impacts from that. But just to sort of wrap up, because we're almost at time here,
sure.
I'm wondering what you think about the labor landscape in McGill and whether you see a sort of sea change at all, because, obviously the AMPL for the past few years has been making waves, but now we're seeing the arts faculty recently applying for certification, the Faculty of Education battling for its certification as a union. If the AMPL does land a collective agreement with McGill, how, in your opinion, would that just affect the other unions' paths and, I guess, professors and larger workers' organization at the university?
Sure. Well, I mean, we're very hopeful that once we have a collective agreement, that it can serve as a model, not maybe in a perfect model, but at least a skeletal model to some extent for our sister unions in education and arts, and as an example for others who are so inclined to organize themselves and to aspire toward. We already have some significant gains, just from the negotiation. One of those includes a grievance process that allows us access to outside arbitration where there's any kind of a disciplinary matter, or really any matter within the collective agreement, which at McGill now is simply not on the books. The only opportunity you have to go to arbitration outside of McGill is in a case of dismissal, but dismissal cases are relatively rare. What's much more common are cases of reprimand or cases of administrative decisions that disadvantage colleagues. So there are already significant advantages like that. There is already, through the collective bargaining process, I think, a much greater opportunity to actually engage in a very granular and detailed working out of the delivery of the academic mission of the university in a way that we just never otherwise had access to, prior to this. For, among other reasons, the general university professors, university association, MAET, the people who work there are wonderful people and are all well-intended. But when they meet with the administration, if they have a disagreement with the administration, there's absolutely nothing they can do. All they can do is act as individuals and look for a job somewhere else. And if they get a job offer somewhere else, they can come back to McGill and try to improve things for themselves. But collectively, they don't have the right to withdraw their labor, and so it's somewhat limited the amount of pressure that they can put on the administration to, for example, adopt more creative and robust measures during a time of COVID, or, for example, to engage in more in robust consultations over various policies and decisions that the university may make from time to time.
All right. Well, we'll have to wait and see how it all plays out on April 23rd, whether or not you guys come to an agreement with McGill. But I'm sure our listeners will be keeping abreast of that for sure. Evan Fox-Deason, thank you so much for coming on CKUT. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for your time. Take care.
All right. You too. Bye-bye. And that was Evan Fox-Deason of the AMPL, the Association of McGill Professors of Law, who are threatening an indefinite strike if McGill doesn't come to the table and negotiate a collective agreement by April 23rd. I'm Jules Bichel, and you've been listening to the Local Journalism Initiative Roundup here on CKUT. As always, you can find all the stories that I do at ckut.ca/LJI. And I'll be around working on things at the station later in May and June, but we're going to take a little break for the next 3 weeks. The show is going to be off the air, so feel free to peruse the web archives to keep up with some of the great local journalism that's happening. We also have an active news collective that you can join at any time by emailing spokenword@ckut.ca. Thanks so much for listening. Take care.
Funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Sego, sewaguego. Yoktagoyanyats. Hello, my name is January Rogers, and I'm your host on Words and Culture. Skanagoaga, do you carry the great peace with you? This is a common or general greeting in the Mohawk Ganyagaha language. I am Mohawk or Ganyagahaga from Six Nations. I am your host for Words and Culture, the Haudenosaunee language episodes, and I had the great honor to join the Cayuga language class at Six Nations Polytechnic for their language games night. They had several game stations set up where students could wander from game to game. Stations like Bone Dice or Indian Dice, Tic-Tac-Toe, Bone and Toggle, and the classic card game Go Fish. It was a great turnout of teachers, students, and their families joining in. And of course, there was food, yummy stew and corn soup, strawberry drink with biscuits and cookies, all homemade, which inspired a warm and welcoming atmosphere to the night. You could feel the close-knit dynamics amongst everyone there. And again, I was just so honored to be part of their very fun and heartwarming night of language games.